right, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. Hope you guys are all right. Nothing really going on in the world, is there? But yeah, so let's escape from all the madness and have a bit of Oasis-related fun, shall we? We have got a really cool episode today with Nick Brine, who for years I've just knew as kind of the name on the Morning Glory and Be Here Now sort of credits. Who is this guy? He was the engineer on those albums. We've seen a lot more of him recently on the Rockfield documentaries. And now we're speaking to him. Really excited to speak to Nick. Lovely guy. Amazing story. Incredible story. Like I said in the episode, there should really be a biopic of this guy's life because it's just ridiculous. Just imagine being there at like 17 years old, dealing with the Stone Roses, 18 years old, dealing with Oasis. It's just nuts. But anyway, so that's what we're going to be talking about today. Nothing massively interesting news-wise. The Camel Fat tune is officially out now that Noel appears on, but we kind of talked about that when we had that sort of minute or so clip of it, so there's nothing much really more to add about that. So I think we're okay. I think we're good to go. So let's cross over to me talking to Nick Brine. So welcome to the Oasis podcast, Nick Brine.
How you doing?
Very good, very good. Really good to speak to you. And it's been, pretty busy few weeks for you, I imagine.
Yeah, it has, yeah. Since the Watch the Story documentary came out, I've been pretty busy on social media. Lots of people talking about it, speaking to me about it. Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And yeah, and so just going back to the actual, like, that documentary kind of coming about, I mean, how did that, were you sort of initially approached or Kingsley initially approached by Noel's team to sort of book that in? And it must have been tricky with, I imagine it was filmed quite recently, so with sort of lockdown, was that difficult?
They approached us a while back at the studios about doing it. And then contacted me and said it'd be good to have me around. Obviously, one of the few people who were actually involved in the session. With lockdown, I mean, we had to make sure there was no other bands in at the time, limit the people, lots of things in place. But Rockfield are on top of all that anyway. So, we still got bands in recording all the time anyway, so we're kind of used to it now.
I was wondering about that, actually, whether or not how badly you've been affected, or I suppose what were you just closed for that actual lockdown period, but then sort of opened up again since?
Yeah, just the initial period, and then from July, when it was okay with the Welsh government, because slightly different to in England. Obviously, lots of things in place, but it's all working out. People get on. I mean, it's a big place. There's lots of space there. So there's a limit to the amount of people we can have there, but generally it's so far so good.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. And just taking it back to your career, because you've been at Rockfield, well, since you were 16 years old, right?
Yeah, 27 years, yeah.
That is crazy.
A long time. So
when did you, were you just sort of straight out of school and were you always interested in music production?
Yeah, I mean, I was playing in bands, and I was always recording my rehearsals. I was a lot more interested in how the records were made, where they were made, reading the covers of my vinyls. I wasn't planning on going into the industry at the time, but I was still doing my GCSEs. A friend of mine who'd been an assistant at the studio said he was leaving and said, "I think you'd really enjoy the job. You should go for an interview." So I literally finished my last GCSE on the Friday, went for an interview with Kingsley. I didn't actually say anything at the interview. Kingsley spoke to me for about an hour, told me all about the business, and then just said, if you still wanted to do it, give me a ring when I got home, so which I did. And he said, okay, good, start on Monday. And that was it. So my whole period between school and working life was that one weekend. I had a paper round on the Saturday, then my Sunday job, and then started at Rockfield on the Monday.
That is crazy. How cool is that, though?
I know, I know.
So when people say to you, when people try and get into the industry, you say, well, yeah, there you go. Go and have a meeting with Kingsley on the day of your GCSE results. Yeah.
Yeah. So nobody knew where I'd gone because everyone assumed I was going to sixth form and then to university. And I just disappeared over the summer. And I think the first time everybody saw me was when I walked into school with Ian Brown to get my GCSE results.
With Ian Brown?
Yeah, well, I didn't drive because I was only 16 and... He said to me, oh, it's results day today. You're not going up to get yours. And I said, well, I don't think I really need them anymore because I'm just going to do this from now on. And he said, oh, I'll take you up then. So he drove me up to the school and we went and got my results.
Wow. So was the Stone Roses Second Coming, was that pretty much the first thing you worked on then?
It was about 6 weeks after I'd started. The first thing was a band called Sepultura doing an album called Chaos AD. With producer Andy Wallace. That was the first thing. There was a couple of little things, and then the Stone Roses came in.
Wow. And what's your... you said you kind of started out as kind of T-boy, but were you... So you were getting the tees for the bloody Stone Roses at 16 years old. Yeah. That's ridiculous.
I know. They just kind of gave me the keys and said, keep them happy. I was kind of like showing them... They knew Monmouth anyway, but I'd kind of take them around the town and... which were the cool pubs and all those kind of things, but they'd been there before, so they pretty much knew anyway. Because there was lots of spare time on that session because they were there for 14 months. So yeah. For me, it was a godsend because Simon Dawson, who was the engineer on the session, said, well, you've got all this spare time. He had no problem with me bringing my band in and using the studio to record. He said, it's the best way you're going to learn. So when they weren't there, then I'd bring my band in, and very quickly got to learn how to use the studio, and then started being able to do a lot more in the studio pretty quickly.
That is amazing. Were you there for the famous story when Oasis came over the hills from when they were at Mono Valley?
Yeah, yes, we saw them a few times towards the end of the Roses session. I'd seen them a couple of times. They used to come and hang out outside the Robin Hood in Monmouth and... see if Manny could buy them a pint. And they'd come up to the studio. Liam would borrow Manny's bike to get into town. And then the one time when they turned up, they all came in with a demo and played us the early recordings of Definitely Maybe.
And did you, were you sort of into sort of indie music and that sort of stuff at that time? And did you remember?
Yeah, I was a fan of the Stone Roses anyway, before they came to the studio. I'd been predominantly into rock music and then that kind of died out in the late 80s. But I got into kind of indie music then, and Stone Roses, one of the first bands that I'd got into, and a band called Teenage Fan Club.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a baptism of fire, both in terms of seeing the playing, because I don't think there is probably, obviously maybe Ian Brown's vocals aren't exactly Mariah Carey, but you know, in terms of playing, I don't think anyone touches the Stone Roses like it. So that's quite a high bar to set for you to be your pretty much one of your first sessions.
Yeah, I was blown away. I mean, I'd been to lots of gigs. I was at gigs most weekends when I was at school. So I've seen a lot of great bands, but to be in the room with them, and I'd get to sit in the corner while they were just jamming and while they were playing and watching Rennie was just absolutely out of this world. but all of them, yeah, when they were on it, it was amazing.
That is incredible. That's super cool. And then, so then that session, that's so crazy. I mean, it's sort of mentioned in the doc, but the fact that you've got, you know, Oasis recording an album down the road, and then they come in to like to do their second album, and Stone Roses are like still doing the first one. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. So it was a long time. And so many great bands came through the studio while the Stone Roses were in. So we were supposed to do 6 weeks, but it ended up being 14 months. But
so how did that work? Like, just on logistics, were you sort of saying, oh, like, sorry, you know, Teenage Fan Club or whoever, like, you've got to, you know, the Stone Roses need this week, or, you know, how did they kind of figure all
that
stuff out?
Yeah, I mean, they were just, well, you just had to block book it out, and they were just, you know, it was just a case of, well, let us know when you're done. And it just kind of went on and on and on and on. But for me, I couldn't have asked for anything more, because it gave me that whole period of time to learn how to engineer. And so much free studio time that within kind of 6 months, I was kind of operating the studio, no problems. And then when there was a break, the studio put me on to engineer a few sessions kind of really early on. So when I was still 16.
That is ridiculous. I don't think I ever clocked that you were like 16, 17 doing the Oasis stuff. You know, you must be one of the youngest like engineers, like Pete, to be named on the Oasis album, you know, and at 17 bloody years old. That's ridiculous.
I know. Yeah, I was just lucky to get into it at that young age. And it just suited me, and being at Rockfield suited me, and the people there were amazing. And Simon Dawson took so much time to kind of train me. We just spent all the spare time we had just going through things, and he was asking questions. So I was up and running pretty quickly. And then after that, Owen Morris, just spent years working with him. And again, he took the time and just taught me loads. So I owe those two kind of everything for starting my career out, really.
Yeah. So did you know Owen before the Oasis sessions?
Yeah, I worked on 1977, the Ash album. And a couple of other little things, because Owen had started using Rockfields. So we'd done a couple of other things, yeah. So by the time we did What's the Story, I'd already done a few sessions with him.
Fair enough. And just one of the things to pick up, mentioning 1977, I think that is one of the best produced albums ever. I just the sound on the album that Owen and obviously yourself have managed to get is just unbelievable for basically a three-piece band that were kids, you know, they were kids themselves.
Yeah, we were all the same age, yeah.
That is ridiculous.
It's a great sounding album, isn't it? It really is. Yeah, you know, they all knew what they were doing. Tim was really on it. And, Owen, really creative with the drum sound, everything. Again, I think, you know, they had those songs in that studio, the Coach House studio, they really suited them, the layout of it. Owen suited the production style they were after. I think it just all fell into place. And we had a great time making it.
And then talking about a great time, one of the most disgusting things I've ever heard on record. It was amazing that I sort of clocked that you're listed as I can't remember what you're like recording engineer or something of Sick Party, which is that, if people don't know, is the like the hidden track at the very end of the album, which is absolutely disgusting. It's basically
horrible.
All the lads being sick and stuff. What you've got to tell me about that?
Yeah, it's horrible. So it'd been decided that that's what we were gonna partake in. A party, but how could we party even harder? And it was the Sick Party. They were all outside doing what they were doing. I had to set it up. Obviously chose the most expensive microphone to mic up the Sick Party. And then I remember that Owen had left the speakers on full, and as I walked into the control room, I think Mark was sick right by the mic, and it just blasted out the speakers, and it just made me absolutely wretch. And I was just thinking, what the hell are we doing here?
So it wasn't. I've always assumed it was just like a caught, you know, just something that was caught on the fly. No, this was planned.
Semi-planned. There were some other party ideas, but we won't go into those.
But yeah, I mean, there is one. I think I probably know, and I'm going to drop in a clip here. So for people that are listening, I'm sorry, you might want to skip like 15 seconds, but there is one where you can just hear this wretch and the sick just hit. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah,
you know, it just
horrific.
Sounds so
yeah.
bad.
Yeah.
When is Nick going to give us a nod or what?
No, it's fucking recording. Come on.
Come on. That's fucking amazing. Come on. That's fucking amazing. That's wrong.
Yeah, so thanks for that, Nick. Making sort of everyone that sort of put that album on to go to sleep when they're a teenager and then they get woken up by that. Yeah, thanks.
I know. Yeah. Yeah, certainly so sticks in the memory, that one.
Ugh, gross. So then the Oasis session comes around. I mean, do you remember like hearing that Oasis were booked and being like, well, were you excited to have them coming in? Because they were on the crest of a wave at the time.
Yeah, well, I was really into Definitely Maybe, big fan of the band, as were all my mates and everything. So, yeah, amazing when Owen said he was going to be bringing them into Rockfield. Just a massive buzz, just to the stage they were at in their careers, the stage I was at in my career, and Owen was on a roll. So, yeah, when I heard that, it was just so excited about it.
Mm. And when they said, because there's a lot of chat about, obviously, you know, them going to the pubs and bringing everyone back from the pubs and things like that. Were your mates, like, were your, like, schoolmates, like, oh, can we come and see Oasis? Like, were they...
kind of kept them away, really. So I was a bit of quality control, so making sure that who came back was all right. Because obviously I knew small town, so I knew kind of everybody. So it didn't kind of happen as much as it's kind of made out. There was the odd night where a few people came back, not loads, but there was only really the one night when loads of people came back. But yeah, I would go out to the pub. I was driving by this point, so I could bring them, pick them up, take them to the pub, and then kind of say, definitely not, or yeah, he's all right. So a bit of quality control. But yeah, my mates were always trying to come back, but it was easy just to keep them away at the time.
That is mad, mate. You know, like, there's that film, like, Almost Famous, about the journo that goes on the road. There is a film of your life to be made, isn't there? Like, a 17-year-old kid, suddenly you're surrounded by all these, like, rock stars. It's just madness. Yeah. I just can't even fathom it.
I know. It's just, and that, to start at that period of time, I think, you know, 1992, when that whole scene was taken off, and then, I mean, you couldn't have asked to be in anywhere better than Rockfield at that point, because every band wanted to come there. That whole 90s scene was kind of just based at Rockfield. It was just band after band after band, great producers, great engineers. So, yeah, couldn't have asked for a better time to come into the industry, really.
Yeah. So talking about the Oasis one specifically, one of the points I've made a couple of times, and it was interesting that it was covered in the documentary, the fact that starting off the album, you have this, like, the clip of Noel, and we now know that he was actually sitting on the Wonderwall playing it, and you can hear the birdsong and stuff in the background. One of the points I've made is that it's a weird way to start the album, because that's super quiet, and it's Wonderwall. So my thinking has always been that it's like a little like a trick, because people, especially, like, if they kind of knew that Wonderwall was going to be massive, so then that people, like, just people buying the album for Wonderwall will put it on, hear Wonderwall playing really quiet and go, oh cool, I like that one, turn it up really loud, and then blast their head off. Do you know about, like, why that was spliced on at the start, and was that kind of the idea?
I'm not entirely sure whether that was discussed as a production thing with Noel and Owen, but my take on it was that the album needed a bit of atmospherics. It needed some kind of intro to the album to kick off those big guitars coming in. And I think when we were doing the outtakes with all the birds going on, the kind of atmosphere around on the outtakes of Wonderwall, I think we clocked it straight away that that was going to be a cool segue to put somewhere on the album. Whether it was so that people would turn it up and get their heads taken off. I mean, it was a loud album anyway, so you didn't really have to worry about that. I'm not entirely sure now.
Fair enough. Yeah, another little point about it is it's interesting that they used strings on the Whatever single, which I know wasn't done with you guys, but then they come in for this album with all these grand songs, and yet they don't do any strings. I think that's, people assume songs like Don't Look Back in Anger, especially in Casting of Shadow, must have strings on them, but they don't. Yeah. There's not a violin on the album. It's all just done with these sort of interesting kind of synths. Would you remember that? Was there ever discussions about bringing in strings on this album?
I mean, I don't think so, because we were just recording so fast and everything was just working and everything was coming together so fast. This song a day. So it was just, we had the Mellotron and the Kurzweil piano there. So it was just crack on, just do them, just to keep the momentum going. I think if we'd have had to stop and go up to London and get the orchestra in and get an arranger in, I think it would have just stopped that momentum. Whether or not there was ever a plan that after they left Rockfield, they would go and do real strings. But then because what was laid down just worked and they decided not to, I'm not 100% sure. But I think it was just, this needs that string part and this needs the Mellotron. So it was just put on there and then, because they were there lying around the studio and it worked and it didn't need anything else. And it just kept that momentum going.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's weird because one of the great things about this album is that you can get hold of, if you search for them, you can get hold of the isolated tracks. Because I think it's been used for Rock Band games and things like that. So, it's great to hear. On Cast No Shadow, and particularly the synth strings on that are very strange. There's a point where it kind of goes like up through it slides up. Yeah. And on the record, it sounds brilliant, but when you isolate it sounds so weird. It sounds
very odd. Yeah.
Do you remember who was doing that? Would that have been Owen, I think, playing those, I believe?
Pretty sure that was Owen. Yeah, Owen did a lot of those parts, the synth parts. There's a few bits like that on the record that when you hear them in isolation, they kind of don't necessarily make sense, but in the track it just totally works. But especially that part, yeah.
Mm. One of the interesting bits that I think really, really makes the album special is, and that I think that a lot of other, well, even other Oasis albums and other bands don't do, is just these little extra bits and extra little touches, whether it's sound effects or, you know, linking songs together and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I love the way that Morning Glory fades out into that bit of the Swamp Song and then fades into Champagne Supernova. Technical thing, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but there's kind of a little bit of a radio tuning in and tuning out, and there's like a song that's like a female vocal and it's like, America, you're on, or something like that. What was that? Was that just messing with the radio, or do you not actually know what that song
it was? Yeah, but I can't remember which track it is. But yeah, that was just messing around to get that little segue there. I'm a big fan of segues on records, little instrumental pieces and all that. And I think, I love those moments on What's the Story when that comes in.
Yeah. So no idea what the song is, though.
Just no.
Whatever was playing on like Radio 1 at the time or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what I love that the fact that as well that is a callback to the end of Armed Walrus, they sort of mess around with the radio. So I don't know if that was ever like a deliberate thing.
I think that's where the idea came from, yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. It's a great idea. And then you obviously you've got the lapping waves of Champagne Supernova and stuff. Is that just a sort of sound effects library?
Sound effects, like yeah. It was just, it sounds great, doesn't it? All that stuff is just amazing soundscape stuff, just mixed in perfectly with in between the tracks and the intro stuff. It just makes that album so good.
Yeah, and the general kind of recording, and we've heard a lot of these kind of stories before, but anything, I mean, I love the sort of the one of the things we hadn't really heard before, I think, was like the air rifles and remote control cars. And it's just seems like, is that a standard thing for a lot of people at Rockfield, or was that Oasis were particularly more kind of playful than the other bands?
Yeah, they're probably slightly more playful than the other bands. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't happen so much now because bands don't come to the studio for those kind of lengths of time. Whereas, you know, youth sessions used to be 6-8 weeks long. So people had a lot more spare time. And once the kind of drums were finished and the drummers kind of sat there doing nothing for weeks on end. So there used to be a lot more of that going on. But yeah, they had kind of more than most going on with the, like you say, the air rifles, the games of cricket, the football games, the remote control cars. Yeah, lots going on, the tractor driving. So a bit of extracurricular activities.
That is absolutely brilliant. And you, as I say, I just keep on to remember, you were a kid. You're just a kid.
I know, I was just a kid. Yeah, I'd only just learned how to drive, just still a kid, still, just learning the trade, but couldn't have, you know, amazing to watch those bands and learnt so much from those, just those few albums at that period of time. You just naming, like, you know, 1977, What's the Story, and Second Coming. I mean, just learnt so much from just being there.
I know, it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, we've got a list of the people that you've worked with there, and it's basically who isn't on there, you know, isn't it? You've got like Bruce Springsteen, Arctic Monkeys, Coldplay, Robbie Williams, The Darkness, Verve, you know, Teenage Fan Club, Super Furry Animals, Beta Band, Stereophonic. It's like, it's basically everyone, you know. Is there anyone that you personally were like really excited to work with that you've ended up working with?
I mean, I was a big Teenage Fan Club fan, so when I got to work with those, that was amazing. But I guess the kind of pinnacle really was getting to go to New York and produce a record that included Bruce Springsteen. So, just amazing. I think I was only about 26 at the time to do that. So yeah, that was an amazing experience. I think at the same time we was in the Hip Factory, I think there was Michael Jackson on the first floor. I was on the second floor with Bruce, Puff Daddy on the third, and I think Elton John was on the fourth floor, I think. So pretty talented building.
That would have been fun in the cafeteria.
Yeah, you couldn't get near anybody.
I was going to say, one of the amazing things from the documentary was... I think Noel had completely forgotten that he'd given you the famous guitar that played Wonderwall.
Yeah, well, it's kind of been knocking about the studios because there was an exhibition at the museum, and the museum asked for it to be part of it, so they built a nice case for it. It was on the display there, so then it's been knocking about since the exhibition finished. And so I thought, I'd bring it in, see if he remembered. And he kind of did a double take, didn't he, as if to say that that's where that went.
Right. Yeah. Well, can I go and have a look at the other studio while I'm here? Because I'm not leaving here again and then fucking saying I've never seen it.
Got your guitar there.
Is that mine?
Do you remember giving me that guitar?
Did I give it to you?
From the sessions.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
No way.
You didn't give me this until Abbey Road, B&O.
Right.
Because mine was in 1,000 pieces on the control room of Abbey Road floor.
Oh, because we're in a fight.
Somebody thought it was yours.
So someone called Liam had smashed my guitar up.
Yeah. So you gave me this one.
No fucking way.
I've had it since then, so 90.
So I would have used it on this record?
So
that's the one I played Wonderwall on. Fucking hell, you jammy bastard. That's going to be worth tens of pounds one day. Giving guitars away?
Yeah.
I must have been high. Was I? I was high, wasn't
I? I think so. Nice one.
Right, let's go and have a look where they did Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, but that was given to me on day one of the Be Here Now sessions at Abbey Road. Yeah, just nice to go through the story of that guitar and the history of that guitar, and for him to remember all the, you know, the things he'd done with it and everything. And it was a bizarre story that how I ended up with the guitar in the first place. Anyway.
Yeah, and would you ever part with it? Have you been contacted by people offering you massive sums for it?
Yeah, I have done for years actually, but especially since the documentary came out, I've had numerous offers and interest from all over the world actually. So yeah, there's quite a lot of interest in it. I've kept it for this length of time. I've never really thought about selling it, but. You know, this you never know. There's a pandemic on, so you never know.
Yeah, well, Mr. Brian Garcia in Texas, I imagine, will be keeping a close eye on it.
Yeah. His name's come up a couple of times.
Fair enough. So going on to the Be Here Now stuff as well, was that then just the connection with Owen? And I suppose, how did it work with Rockfield? When you go off and do these other things, like you said, going to New York or whatever, is that just... Are you sort of tied in with Rockfield, but you can say, well, I'm going to go off and do this for a few weeks? Like, how did that sort of work?
Well, all the engineers there went freelance kind of at the same sort of time when the industry started changing. So we were all then free to work elsewhere. But, I mean, we still use Rockfield for 90% of the stuff because it's still the best studio to go to. And we all just love being there. But so I was freelance, but I was in house as well. So it just enabled me to go off and work with Owen. I think for Be Here Now was the first time that I'd actually said, right, I'll go freelance and work elsewhere, because it was going to be, I think, 6-7 months long. So that was the first kind of main freelance session I did away from the studio.
Wow. And living in London, I suppose, were you sort of having to live in London for a few months?
Yeah, we had. Well, we was at Abbey Road. We stayed in the Abbey Road apartments. But then after that, I think a lot of the time we was in the Marriott Swiss Cottage. So I lived there for months and months and months. Great to live in London again. I was 19 at that point, I think. Being in London for all that time, apart from when we went to Ridge Farm, the rest of it was all done in London.
Yeah. And how was it as a... You know, obviously a student of music and someone that had that or that few years of recording already, to then get to Abbey Road, that must have been a special experience.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, just a buzz to be in that room. Obviously the history of that room, we're coming from a studio that has great history anyway, but to go to possibly the only other major studio in the UK that has that kind of same kind of history as Rockfield and that same kind of feel when you walk in. It was great, but it didn't necessarily work out for us doing Be Here Now there, because obviously we had to leave after a few weeks. But amazing. I got a guided tour around Abbey Road by Sir George Martin. He came in with Jim Carrey one day and said, did I mind if he showed him around the studio? Which of course I didn't. We weren't working that day. I was just in doing some monitor mixes, and we had a whole tour of the studio and him explaining where he set up certain things and what equipment they were using and why they did things this way. So just me, Jim Carrey and George Martin hearing all these stories about those Beatles records.
Oh my God, that's amazing. And so Jim Carrey would have been recording that, he did a version of Iron the Walrus, didn't he?
He did Iron the Walrus, down the road, yeah, I think they were doing that.
Amazing. Wow, what a magic memory that would be.
I know.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
oh, just, Jesus.
Just Jim Carrey nudging me with that grin that he does in all his films, just this biggest smile on his face, nudging me, going, can you believe this is happening? That's like, no.
How do you think I feel, Jim? You're here.
Yeah.
That is crazy. Corporation t-shirts, super bloody Tuesday, man. You've been a naughty boy, you let your face grow. And then the story is that they you're in Abbey Road for a few weeks, but then it was basically you're being too loud and it was kind of affecting other people recording in the other studios. Is that right?
Yeah, I think we had conductors and arrangers coming in, banging on the door, walking in, saying, can you turn it down? I've got bottom end all over my cellos and things like that. So it became kind of easier to leave than to turn it down.
Yeah. And what did you think of the, when you were recording Be Here Now? Because it was a very different sound to both Definitely Maybe and Morning Glory. And it's, you know, fueled, shall we say, in a very specific way. I mean, did you, when you were listening to it, what were you thinking? Were you sort of thinking like, wow, these are long songs and wow, that's, are you sure you want to do another guitar overdub there, Noel?
I mean, I loved the songs on that album. I loved the session. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, it was a lot different to the What's the Story session because of the way it was being done, the way it was more, you know, longer sessions and more pieced together bit by bit, whereas, as I said, the other one was just bang, 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 song after song, day after day. But no, I mean, it was all about being excessive in every way and as many overdubs as we can fit on, and kind of guitars were finished when we ran out of tracks. I mean, at the time, no, I think we were all just immersed in the whole experience of it. But yeah, looking back, it was pretty excessive, some of it. But
yeah,
you know, it was for me, it's still a great record.
I absolutely love it. It's probably, personally, it's my favourite. I don't think it's necessarily the best, but personally, mm-hmm. I think it was where it hit me in my time in my life as well.
Yeah,
I absolutely love that record, and it's just to put it on, it's such a pleasure. There's just so much to hear and so much to enjoy about it. And one of the great things, like we're saying about the sound effects on Morning Glory, once again, there's so much going on. There's toilets flushing, there's what was the thinking with that, like with the little bit of jazz at the end of like Magic Pie, and there's just constantly so much going on that record.
Yeah, little bits going on. Yeah, I mean, it's just the way everyone was thinking at the time, you know. Any time that anything like that happened, it was always made a note of, we got that, we could use that, can we use that? And there was loads more. There was people coming back and we'd do little jams, and it was to put on as little segues, and there'd be, I don't know, somebody, Richard Ashcroft or Steve Craddock or someone, doing something, and all these little bits were put aside to kind of compile later to add to the atmosphere of the album.
It's amazing. And there was a All Around the World was like, obviously it ended up being like a 9 minute song and then the couple of minutes reprise at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, how was that, putting that together? Was it originally like the plan to be like a 12-13 minute song and then they just sort of decided to splice it up?
I'm not 100% sure what the original plan was for it. All I knew is we was going to have a 72 piece orchestra on it, and it was, so it could be as big as possible. So doing those strings was great fun, with Liam kind of conducting from behind the conductor's back, just skipping around the room, making it as difficult as possible, but still great fun.
Yeah, I interviewed Nick Ingman, actually, who did the orchestrations on that album. He was absolutely brilliant. He's sort of so old school, and you know, he sort of said it was quite a juxtaposition, kind of bringing in all those guys. And I think he said a lot of them had actually played on Beatles records, and that was what Noel really wanted.
He did, yeah, and it was like, yeah, everyone was like, he played such and such, and he played such and such, and that's the guy who did that. So it just added to the whole experience and the whole feel of the track, you know.
That is amazing. And sort of just going back to the documentary, how was it, like, you know, meeting Noel and getting to go around the studio and do that? Was that good fun?
Yeah, brilliant fun. As soon as I got asked to do it, I was, you know, obviously well up for it. And to reminisce, and, you know, because I probably remembered, well, I did remember a lot more about it than he did a long time ago, and it was all so fast, and their careers were moving so fast, whereas I was kind of sat back a little bit more, taking it all in. So, yeah, amazing experience, and we had a good chat. And yeah, I think it was just a great couple of days with the team there. Yeah, the history and the bands that had come through and that whole 90s thing that was happening here as well. And for them to come and then make a record here, like a step into the big studio like this place, and you're out of the way and you can just get on and do what you're here to do, which is make a great record, hopefully, which they did.
And then once the tour started, yeah, immediately people were going fucking nuts for it. And then as the singles came out, you know, there was that moment where not many bands get it. We were number one in the singles charts and number one in the albums charts consecutively for weeks. That's the kind of shit I dreamt about when I was at school, do you know what I mean? You know, nothing was ever the same after that. Then the money came in and all fucking hell broke loose. It was like, woohoo! Gonna get me a monkey.
How many special people change? How many lives are living strange? Where were you while we were getting...
And one of the things, I really enjoyed it, but I'll be honest, the one thing I thought was missing, I really would have loved, would be, you know, remember on like VH1 Classic when they sit at the desk and they can sort of move the mixers and they go, oh, let's get the isolated vocal on this one. And you know, like, I would have loved it if they had that. I mean, was there any potential for that? I mean, would the studio still have kind of anything like that? Or was those master tapes just off with, you know, wherever
they are? Yeah, all those master tapes would have left Rockfield to go off for mixing. And then, which was at Orinoco Studios. And then from there, they would have gone off to the label's tape stores, where they probably still are today. So we didn't have any of those tapes. We did. You know, there was a little bit of a discussion of the song-by-song thing. But, yeah, we didn't actually sit down and go through, you know, have the tapes there to go through it.
Yeah, that would have been great because, you know, like when you... Like I was saying, but you know, it's a real shame, I think, that more Oasis stuff hasn't been released on like a track by track, because you know, when you go through it, there are, and it's had to be these things, sort of people going through and breaking Rock Band games and things like that to get hold of it. But each individual track, like,
there's amazing parts on there. You know, bands would have a lot to learn from what's going on those records if they got to hear those individual parts. Yeah, there's so much going on that so well put together. It would be interesting.
I'd love that. Well, maybe for the 50th anniversary, Nick, yeah?
Yeah, I still won't be that old.
Yeah, you won't be. The rest of them will be. Well, fair enough. Well, what's... it's a really exciting as well. Obviously, we had the Rockfield... you know, the couple of things recently. That Rockfield documentary, the feature film, was absolutely brilliant. And then you had the fact that it was featured in Bohemian Rhapsody. Was that, were they key to sort of make sure it was all exactly how the setup happened at the time?
Well, no, the film is actually all on set. So when they filmed the actual movie Bohemian Rhapsody, that was all on a set, actually. So they recreated the studio, but it doesn't actually look that much like the Quadrangle studio. It's more for the film, really, to have that kind of opulent 70s kind of look to the studio with all the lamps and everything. It's not quite what the Quadrangle looks like, but I mean, they've, you know, a lot of the film is set supposedly at Rockfield, but yeah, it's all filmed on set. But what we actually did before, I don't know if you ever saw the BBC documentary on the making of Bohemian Rhapsody. That was something we did there in the Quadrangle when Brian and Roger came back We actually did have the master tapes then. We had the master tapes of Bohemian Rhapsody and got to set those guys up. And they played over Freddie's guide vocals and guide pianos. So got to kind of mess around with all those outtakes of Bohemian Rhapsody as well.
Here, for the very first time, you can hear Freddie Mercury rehearsing the piano parts for what producer Roy Thomas Baker calls Fred's Thing. These outtakes from the original recording sessions at Rockfield have never been heard before.
Two. Take one of Mark II version of Fred's Thing.
That's nice.
I tell you,
it's slower on there.
He just said, look, I've got this very strange thing. You're going to have to be very patient, you know, when we do it, because there'll be a lot of gaps and stuff. But, you know, as soon as really we'd mapped it out, we all sort of understood what was happening. But it was a bit confusing at first, you know. Sort of coming back a bit. Yeah. Mm. I think the piano was about there.
I think it was.
A bit like that.
More like that than like that. And you were over there, but there was no partition for the drums.
Yeah, that's right.
It was just all in one room.
Amazing.
And it must be great. It was so lovely to see Kingsley on the documentaries. He just seems like such a great character.
What a guy.
I love that bit when he was talking about all the big crazy night with all the damage, and he sort of said, well, you know, it happens, you know, they was all good fun and they paid the 800 quid and then they were back, yeah, it was fine, like that. Yeah. I just think that's so cool.
Yeah, no one's too precious there. He's seen it all before. It's not anything he hasn't seen. Yeah, he's been obviously going since the early 60s. Pretty crazy times in the 60s, just wasn't publicised as much as it is now. So he's seen it all before, and it was all about, you know, keeping the bands happy, letting them kind of have a great time. And, you know, they paid the bill. There was money in the 90s, so the record company would just pay the bill. I think they all turned up with flowers for the cleaners, apologies. And, and we just got on with it. They'd seen it all before. It didn't matter.
I love that stuff. You wouldn't catch, you know, like Ed Sheeran like trashing a place and throwing bins around. I wouldn't have thought, would you? Well, as she's speaking about him, you did some bits with Ed Sheeran, haven't you, very early on?
Well, only in the way that I had a studio in Norfolk called Leaders Farm with Dan Hawkins from The Darkness, because Ed was from that area. He used to come around and ring our gate bell and ask if he could have some studio time. But we were so busy there at that studio at the time. That's where we got to have bands like Arctic Monkeys and C6 Steve and Katie Tunstall, Nick Cave, they all came there. So we were really busy, so we couldn't actually get him in the studio. But he was always emailing after some free time. And then, we were involved in a competition that he was in, which he won. Got to support one of our artists that we were working at the UEA there. And, then his career took off after that.
He hasn't done too bad, has he?
He's not done too bad at all, no. And The Darkness got to support him on the last tour as well.
Oh, wow. Cool. All right, and then so it's interesting to hear that some stuff is going to be going on sort of on the back of all these bits. So what the talk is of a nationwide tour with yourself and Kingsley going around doing some sort of Q&As.
Yeah, so that was obviously after the documentary, and there's a few stories in it. It was something we talked about doing, because we actually did one going back last year. After it was to tie in with the museum that had the 6 month Rockfield exhibition on. When the exhibition, at the end of the exhibition, we did a Q&A session, audience with kind of thing. Me, Kingsley, and Lisa, and we had the rock band Thunder, who were kind of comparing the evening and asking all the questions, because they kind of know us all really well, so they were able to prod us and get some stories out of us that maybe others probably wouldn't on the night. So there was about 250 people there in the town hall there in Monmouth, and it was such a success, massive demand for tickets, that we thought after the documentary came out and that interest kind of resurfaced, that it's something we could actually take out on the road and, yeah, just because he's got, I mean, Kingsley's just got, you just need to wind him up and off he goes. It's an entertaining evening, really is.
Well, that would be great. Well, it would be fantastic if we can get, obviously, this bloody pandemic. I was due to, because I've done a couple of Q&As with Oasis people. So I did a couple with Tony McCarroll, I did a couple with Alan McGee. And then the plan was to do more this year. And I actually was booked in to do Savoy Theatre Monmouth with McGee on the 2nd of October. Yeah, and we had to bloody cancel it. So, such a shame. It's currently booked in for 2nd of October next year, but we'll have to see what happens.
We're looking roughly around that time to start next October next year at the Savoy Theatre.
Oh, there we go. Well, I'll come and say hello. But that is absolutely fantastic. You mentioned you're going to be doing a book as well.
Yeah, I've been trying to finish that for 4 years now. More things keep happening, so I keep adding to the book. It's probably 2 books by now, actually. When I got to 40, my daughter said to me, "Dad, now that you're old, do you think you better start writing some of this down?" And because she'd kind of been around when I've been telling a few stories, and she said, I'd like to read them when I'm older. And she'll obviously need to be older when she reads most of them.
But
she's only 10 at the moment. So I started then putting it together, just kind of like for them, really. It started out just sort of write this down for them to read about all these crazy, crazy things that have happened over 25 years at that point. It's pretty much finished now.
Fantastic.
Even I can't believe some of it when I'm reading it back. It's going to be difficult parenting teenagers once they've read the book, I think. Just going to hold a copy of the book up and point at it when I tell them they can't do something, I think.
That is funny. I wonder with that, with the likes of like Liam and Noel, when they're like, you know, when they're trying to tell their kids to behave, and it's like,
How can you?
I thought taking drugs was like having a cup of tea, Dad.
I know. It's going to be a few awkward moments, but it's good fun. You know, it's not sensationalized. Just everything happened I was actually there for, so it's good to kind of fly on the wall things. There's some technical things in there, some interesting facts, and some pretty mental stories. It's a good collection of anecdotes.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll very much look forward to reading that. I tell you what would be great. I think once we put this out, because I'm sure there is a load more questions that the listeners will come up with. So it'd be fantastic to maybe do a part two with listeners' questions. Because Noel's listeners' questions were all right, but you know, some of us are shouting like, "Well, no, we want the actual ins and outs of like." And there's geekier people that listen to this that want to ask about microphones and amplifiers and all that sort of stuff that I don't understand.
Course, yeah.
So that might be great to do that in the future, Nick, if you'd be up for it.
Yeah, definitely.
Wonderful. Cool. All right. Well, where can people find you online if they want to look you up, yourself and Rockfield?
So obviously, we can go on www.rockfieldstudios.com or rockfieldmusicgroup.com. You can also go on my studio website, leadersvale.com, leaders, LEEDERS. And on there's a little bit about me and our studios there, because we've got our own studios in Wales as well. We use Rockfield, and then we've got studios in Spain as well. So we're busy all the time in all the three different places. So, they can go on there, and obviously on my social media as well. I'll keep everyone informed on when the book's coming out and the tour for next year.
Fantastic. And I didn't prepare you on this, but we normally end with the favourite Oasis song of the guest's choice. So have you got a particular Oasis song that means a lot to you?
Champagne Supernova, I think.
Yeah,
It's always been my favourite Oasis song. There's many. I think definitely maybe because tracks on there because of the age it was and all my mates being into it and what that album meant to us, putting it on before we went out, all those kind of things. So I could pick any off that album, really. But yeah, Champagne Supernova's always been my favourite song, I think.
Yeah, and there's obviously it's been well documented, but Liam coming in and just pretty much nailing the vocals in like two or three takes every single time. I mean, as someone that's worked with hundreds of singers, is that usual or is that unusual for someone to be
unusual.
Come in and do that?
Yeah, a big vocal like that, quite unusual. And I think that's part of maybe why that's my favourite song. Watching that, everyone's hairs in the back of their neck standing up and him doing that performance. Kind of everyone standing in the control room just watching it and him nailing it.
Mm. And I suppose the fact that he wasn't like, you know, this isn't someone that's gone to Brit school. You know what I mean? This isn't like a trained singer. This is just a kid that's just blessed with this voice.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, they hadn't lived with those songs for very long, though a lot of those songs were new. So it had a very short period of time to get to know a lot of those songs. So you kind of have to get inside the song very quickly and learn how to perform it very quickly. So to walk in and just nail that vocal, which is so good, just amazing. And Wonderwall as well, you know, another great vocal.
Yeah, unbelievable. There we go. Well, we'll leave it there, Nick, but thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, and we'll finish with a bit of Champagne Supernova. But for now, Nick Bryan, thank you very much.
Cheers, James. Take care, mate.
Someday you will find me caught beneath a landslide in a champagne supernova, a champagne supernova. 'Cause people believe that they're gonna get away for the summer. But you and I will live and die. The world's still spinning round. We don't know why. Why. Na, na.
So there we go. I really hope you enjoyed that. Really lovely to speak to Nick. What a great guy. And as he said then, hopefully we'll come back and do a second one, maybe a listener's questions, maybe we'll get out on the road, maybe do something together on the road. So yeah, really exciting stuff. Great to hear from Nick. And I hope you guys enjoyed it. I think that will do it for today. Thank you very much for listening to the Oasis podcast. And most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is and it's greatly, greatly appreciated. You can become a patron at patreon.com/oasispod. Which is where we post extra stuff and the episodes always go up there a day or two early. So do make sure you go and check that out. Do follow on the social medias if you can. Twitter and Facebook and Instagram is where I tend to hang out on Twitter the most. Do please review on iTunes and subscribe over there if you're not. And generally spread the word. I do really appreciate it if you can let friends know if they are fans of Oasis and they're not listening to the podcast. They're massively, massively missing out. So let them know. All right, that will do it for today. Thanks again. Stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.
hold on. Keep it up. Yeah, fuck round of applause. hold on, right? I want to get more up. Hold on, right?
Come on. Go on, finale.